If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. There are several different tiers available and perks to go along with each, including an exclusive monthly series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide whether or not they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate any and all donations, as they help tremendously with research and production costs. Now onto the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Very much the all-American girl next door, everyone's sweetheart. I think that's why it's still alive this many years. We wanted closure, we wanted resolution, we wanted justice for her and her family.
The mid-1970s were a turbulent time for the United States. Society had been rapidly changing for many years. The Vietnam War was, at that point, condemned by a clear majority of Americans who had realized its futility and the exorbitant cost of the destruction of human life that it wreaked. Crime was out of control. Drugs were pouring into the country. In 1974, the war waging in Southeast Asia was winding down. Most American soldiers leaving Vietnam had a tough time readjusting to life back in the States. Some of them struggled with emotional problems, physical injuries, drug addiction, or any combination of these from their time in Vietnam. Many returned home unable to find jobs due to the recession that was brought on by an oil crisis, a crashing stock market, high unemployment, and high inflation. Violent crime had become an epidemic. 1974, in fact, was the second highest year for homicide and non-negligent manslaughter on record in the United States. Texas, of course, wasn't immune to these statistics. A slew of murders along Texas highways, known as the Killing Fields, had been taking place since the early 1970s. These slayings would continue until the early 90s. This period was significant in helping Texas become the state with the second highest number of serial killings in the U.S., trailing closely behind California. Texas was seemingly a prime stomping ground for serial murderers and repeat sexual offenders. The city of Fort Worth has a few nicknames. It is most commonly referred to as Cowtown. Less known to non-locals, however, is the nickname Panther City. This name came to be a couple years after the city was dealt a hard economic blow, resulting from factors including a brutal winter in 1873 that was devastating to the cattle and railroad industries, two top Fort Worth revenue makers. The population of the city plummeted. There was no work, no pay. In 1875, Dallas lawyer Robert Cowart said about Fort Worth, where he'd lived previously and apparently wasn't too fond of, that it was, to paraphrase, such a drowsy, dismal place that he saw a panther asleep on a downtown street in front of the courthouse. Fort Worth recovered, of course, in spades, and the nickname was embraced by residents and local government who were amused by the moniker, only now they thought of it as a sign of strength and perseverance. The panther has been on the Fort Worth police badge since 1912. An animal of prey as an epithet might also, perhaps, be fitting for an entirely different reason. Predators stalked the quiet city for many years, many so mysterious in their perpetrations that they remain nameless and faceless. Fort Worth has over 900 cold cases dating back to the 1950s. A tremendous number of those are remnants of the crime-laden 1970s. Though Fort Worth didn't lag far behind other comparable cities in murder rates and sexual assault cases, its 375,000 citizens didn't seem to give it a second thought. The growing city had never lost its small-town charm, hospitality, or the feeling of safety for many of its residents, especially those who lived on the outskirts of downtown in any one of the middle-class suburban neighborhoods. Benbrook, with about 8,200 residents, was one of those suburbs. Western Hills High School sits atop the suburb, and a vast majority of the students who attended in the early to mid-70s considered Benbrook, as well as the high school, a safe and normal place to grow up.
As far as we were all concerned at Western Hills High School, we were your typical all-American Texas high school, very into football, very into baseball and sports. I would say the majority of us were like middle-class families, and at that time in the mid-70s, you didn't hear about death. Things were a little more innocent then. Those things probably were happening at the time. We just didn't know about them as much. They weren't as pervasive in our everyday life and in our culture. I think we all took for granted that we were safe and nothing could happen to us, and we were well taken care of and loved by our families, and nothing bad would happen. Fort Worth has always had that reputation of feeling like, a sleepier hometown, kind of friendlier place. And it definitely was then. It was just a nice, safe place to live.
Thursday, February 14th, 1974, at Western Hills High School. Valentine's Day. While the excitement of the upcoming Valentine's dance on Saturday was buzzing through the halls, girls' tennis coach Mrs. Lee Martin had postponed practice this day for an exclusive presentation for her class. Towards the end of the 1960s and into the early 70s, the second wave of the feminist movement was bringing the issue of violence against women into the forefront. Women-focused self-defense programs were on the rise to empower women to become their own protectors. Fort Worth police officer James Johnson showed the tennis class a film titled The Lone Woman. This how-to film gave explicit instructions on what a woman should do in the event of an attack against her. It is likely the audience that day did not truly comprehend the relevance that the film flickering before their eyes would soon have, and many may have brushed it off as adult paranoia propaganda, because at that age, the feeling of invincibility is at its peak. And anyway, this was a day for love and romance. It isn't negligent to presume that Valentine's Day and the upcoming dance were foremost on the minds of the average, hopelessly romantic Western Hills student. After stopping the film, Officer Johnson turned the classroom lights on and glanced around at the young women seated before him. He reiterated the importance of the film because he wasn't sure they understood. These young women didn't fathom the dangers that were lurking outside the high school doors, around every corner, and behind every shadow. The dangers he witnessed every day. Scanning the room with his eyes, he emphasized his words carefully. Do not think this can't happen to you. Among the approximately 14 students in the classroom that day was a petite, fair-haired student named Carla Jan Walker. Carla was a precocious 17-year-old and a junior at Western Hills High. She'd grown up in the friendly southwest Fort Worth suburb of Benbrook. Her family were a tight-knit bunch that included Charlene, Carla's mother, who managed a boutique at the time, and Layton, a lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. He served as a pilot in World War II and was currently stationed at Carswell Air Force Base. Carla was the fifth child out of the six born to Charlene and Layton. She had two older brothers, Tommy and Steve, an older sister, Cindy, and a younger brother, Jim. Blonde-haired and blue-eyed, Carla stood 4'11", weighed 105 pounds, and had a good-spirited, though incredibly feisty and stubborn, personality. The family, in fact, called her Little Spitfire. She was an above-average student, worked diligently on the school paper, and was actively involved in the tennis club. Carla was outgoing, energetic, and always smiling. Well-liked by everyone, she never had a problem making a friend. People flocked to Carla. She was magnetic.
She was very much the all-American girl next door, just everyone's sweetheart. She was very nice and very fun and upbeat and very positive young woman, and had a lot of potential there. She was one of those girls that everyone liked, that no one talked bad about behind her back or was catty about. She was well-liked by everyone.
Excited about the future, Carla's plan was to attend summer school so that she could graduate a semester early. She was motivated to get an early start in life and intended to enroll at Tarrant County Junior College to knock out her basics before transferring to a university, likely Texas Tech. She was undecided in a major, but knew she had time to figure all the details out. Rodney McCoy, an 18-year-old senior and Carla's boyfriend for the past year, played on the varsity football and baseball teams. Though he had recently moved with his family to a neighboring district, the popular quarterback decided to finish out his year at Western Hills High School. Rodney was sweet-natured and polite, and Leighton and Charlene all but immediately accepted Rodney into the Walker family and treated him like one of their own. They thought of him as a son, attending his games and always setting a place for him at the Walker family dinner table. Carla was Rodney's biggest fan on and off the field. She spent considerable time before each of Rodney's games and pep rallies, making posters to show her support for him and the rest of the Western Hills Cougars. Though they had many friends and enjoyed socializing, Carla and Rodney preferred to spend time together, just the two of them, or with her sister Cindy and her boyfriend. The couple most often hung out in the room that Carla and Cindy shared, studying, listening to music, talking, and playing games. They were a normal, though popular, high school couple. On Friday night, February 15th, the weekly beer bust was held at Betty's Hole, a popular, semi-secluded spot on Benbrook Lake, where all the local kids hung out, drank, partied, and whatever else it is burgeoning young adults do. Carla, Rodney, and approximately 50 other Western Hills High School students ended up attending the party that Friday. The good times generally outweigh the bad at these things, but it is inevitable that at least one instance of teenage drama will occur. At the beer bust, Rodney and Carla were hassled by an older male youth. The youth had been brazenly flirting with Carla, his attempt, apparently, to antagonize Rodney. When the party began winding down, Carla, Rodney, and many of the other students left and met up at Mr. Quick Hamburgers on Camp Bowie Boulevard. Mr. Quick was a popular hangout for the kids, as was the open late Taco Bell that it shared a parking lot with. The harassment from the older youth at the lake openly continued there, and though there was no physical fight between the two, Rodney was highly annoyed and visibly agitated. The night ended without any serious incident. On Saturday, February 16th, the Valentine's dance looming, Carla borrowed a light blue dress from her older sister Cindy. Her mother did some slight alterations on the gown, as Cindy was several inches taller. The dress was long, sleeveless, and trimmed in white lace. Carla adorned her eyelids with a matching blue shadow, and her flowing long hair was curled, falling around her shoulders. Though it was a chilly February evening, in the high 50s, she wouldn't wear a sweater or jacket. But anyone who is familiar with a typical Texan's perpetual defiance of winter can attest that this is not particularly unusual. As Carla waited for Rodney to pick her up, she visited with some family who were in from out of town. Rodney arrived a little late in a sports jacket, slacks, and tie, corsage in hand. The couple headed out in Rodney's car to enjoy their evening. They first dined at the Wharf, a seafood restaurant located a short distance from Carla's home, before heading to Western Hills High for the Valentine's dance. The cafeteria of the school was decorated in paper hearts and blared top 40 hits, which echoed and vibrated down the school's hallways. When Carla and Rodney arrived after 7 p.m., the dance was in full swing. This was your typical high school dance. You dress up, dance with your steady, show up hoping to see someone or hoping someone sees you. A night like this, filled with fun and laughter, maybe an elaborate prank or two, or maybe a first kiss with your first love, forever remains in the recesses of the mind, creeping out every so often so that you might relive being young and carefree. By all accounts, Carla appeared to have had an enjoyable time. She was enthusiastic, jovial, smiling, just being Carla. Carla and Rodney stayed that evening until the dance started to die down. As they were leaving, Carla stopped to talk with one of her teachers. She told her that she had a great time and thanked her for chaperoning, before ending the conversation with, "I'll see you on Monday." Carla and Rodney left with another couple, the young man a teammate of Rodney's, around 11:30 p.m. None of these teenagers were necessarily ready to call it an evening. They dropped the couple back off at their car at Western Hills High about an hour later. Wanting to see what else was happening, Carla and Rodney drove to the Taco Bell, where they grabbed a bite and chatted with some friends. Thanks to vandals, no doubt teenaged, the bathrooms at Taco Bell and Mr. Quick were closed to the public, so the Ridgely Bowling Alley down the street had become the spot for the kids to go when they needed to powder their noses or relieve themselves. Sometime shortly after 1 a.m., now Sunday the 17th, of course, Carla and Rodney returned to the bowling alley, parking in the same back lot they had been just an hour before. Because it was so late, the crowd there had all but dissipated. Rodney accompanied Carla into the establishment so she could use the restroom. The couple returned to Rodney's car and climbed in. Carla sank back against the passenger door, and Rodney slid across the bench seat of his car. They kissed. The two were unaware and unprepared for what was coming. It only took a minute. A minute that would change the entire course of so many people's lives. A minute that would inflict so many with a lifetime of torturous, unanswered questions and all-consuming regret. One long, terrifying minute. Without warning, the passenger side door of the vehicle is jerked open. Rodney instinctively grabbed a hold of Carla as she fell back into the arms of a strange man poised to catch her. Rodney, startled and confused, shouted, "What is this?" As he struggled to pull Carla out of Rodney's tight grip, the man looked directly at Rodney and said confidently, "I'm going to kill you." The stranger proceeded to bludgeon Rodney over the head with the butt of a pistol until he loosened his grip on Carla. The man was able to pull her completely out of the car. Carla was screaming. Rodney was weakened and impaired, fighting to stay conscious from having received so many blows to his head. His fight response kicked in, and Rodney attempted to exit the vehicle through the passenger door in an effort to gain control over the situation, but froze in fear when the man lowered his gun to his face and pulled the trigger three times. Everything began to fade out as Rodney lost consciousness. It's difficult to imagine how that moment felt for Rodney, this unexpected, fleeting moment where a correct and effectual reaction was impossible. The moment when your body fails you. The moment where every ounce of innocence in your being is violently sucked into oblivion and replaced with hopelessness. That excruciatingly brief moment that will unconsciously dictate every breath you take for the rest of your life. Several minutes later, Rodney started to stir. His consciousness was, at least partially, returning. The chaos had been replaced by placidity. He was alone in the quiet. The silence provided him with an awareness of his senses, and Carla was gone. Panic overtook him, and he forced himself into action. He pulled himself into the driver's seat and started the car. Dazed and unable to focus his eyes, Rodney put the car in drive and frantically tore out of the parking lot, barely avoiding a head-on collision with an unsuspecting motorist. Rodney's trip was less than a mile, and when he arrived at the Walker home, he slammed his car into the curb. The vehicle came to a halt halfway in the driveway, the other half in the yard. He threw himself against the weight of the car door as he opened it and jolted to the front door of the house. Inside, the family had been visiting with each other and waiting for the couple's return. They were abruptly startled by the commotion outside and didn't even make it to the door before Rodney began frantically ringing the doorbell and banging loudly and erratically. As the door opened, Rodney burst into the home, hysterical and covered in blood. Rodney, in complete distress, yelled out, "They've got her. They're going to hurt her real bad." The Walkers tried to calm Rodney enough to make sense of the situation, Mr. Walker was immediately on the move, grabbing for his pistol and car keys. Mrs. Walker called the Benbrook police and an ambulance. Mr. Walker hurriedly got in his car and sped toward the bowling alley. He quickly searched the parking lot and went to the front door of the establishment. The doors were locked and everything appeared closed. He desperately pounded on the door, but no one appeared. He moved on and quickly searched the immediate area before returning home. Carla's sister Cindy accompanied Rodney in the ambulance to Peter Smith Hospital. Mrs. Walker followed behind in her car. Rodney's mother had been alerted and was there waiting when the ambulance pulled up to the emergency room doors. Seeing that he was not alone, Cindy and Mrs. Walker got back into their car and hurried home. Because the scene of the abduction was Fort Worth police jurisdiction, they were contacted and were dispatched to the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley at 2 a.m. Mrs. Walker was unable to reconcile the evening's events. She wanted to believe that this all had to be some sort of bad joke. The next few days were a whirlwind for the Walker family. The FBI, who were called in almost immediately, the Fort Worth police, and the Benbrook police, swarmed around the Walker house constantly, trying to eke out any leads that the family might provide, which wasn't much, as they were still trying to come to terms with the severity of the situation. Anyway, the Walkers didn't know who would do something like this, especially to Carla. Most of the Western Hills student body was scrutinized and/or questioned, seemingly, with an emphasis on those who attended the Valentine's dance.
She was abducted after our high school Valentine dance, and I was at the Valentine dance because I was editor of the yearbook at the time, and it was my job at the Valentine dance to present the class favorites. So I was at the dance, and I remember seeing Carla and Rodney there, and you know, just the casual hello and everything. I didn't know about the abduction until the next night, a good 24 hours later, because as I said back then, we didn't have a 24-hour news cycle, so you didn't really find out your news until, you know, 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock at night, usually. And so it was on the Sunday news that she had been abducted. And we were all just shocked, stunned by that turn of events. And the next day at school on Monday, I was called into the principal's office, which was a rarity for me because I was not one of those students that was often called into the principal's office. So when I got there, there was a police officer, the principal, and our yearbook advisor. And they had contact sheets of pictures that had been taken at the Valentine dance. And they wanted me to help them identify people in the pictures so they could kind of look and see if there was somebody at the dance who was out of place or who looked out of place. And so I remember doing that. And it became very real to me at that point that this was a horrible thing that had happened. And I was very scared for Carla and her family. After that, the news crews kind of descended upon the high school, and I'm sure as you've done your research, you've seen lots of stories and pictures and articles from Star Telegram and the Fort Worth Press that was active at the time about things going on at the school. There were search parties. We were all glued to the news at 6 and 10 p.m. to get any sort of update, so we really relied on the news for our information.
Hundreds of tips were called in from the public, and the police claimed that every tip was followed up on. Multiple sightings of Carla were reported, but not a single one could be confirmed. The police pleaded for the public's help through news outlets due to the lack of clues and evidence of Carla's location. During the effort to find her, the Fort Worth Police, the Benbrook Police, and the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office utilized every available officer on any given shift, many working beyond hours required. In fact, the search for Carla was described as the most massive police effort ever conducted by Fort Worth police up until that time. The entirety of Benbrook Lake, located less than 10 miles from the Walker home, was scoured by officers on horseback the following days. Officers on foot searched with metal detectors for clues as to what happened to Carla. A helicopter was employed. Countless friends, family, and fellow students from Western Hills and many other schools in the surrounding areas looked around the city, suburbs, lakeside, and the countryside, both day and night. A reward fund was quickly established for any information leading to the young woman's whereabouts. A sizable portion of the fund was collected by Western Hills students and the students from other schools around the region. Most of her friends thought that Carla's abductor was drunk or doped up and would drop her off in a few days, or at least call her parents and demand a ransom. Their understanding of the situation was unable to go beyond the types of kidnappings you see in the movies or on television. But everyone was scared. This wasn't something that happens in Benbrook, Texas. Carla's disappearance awoke a new and frightening reality in children, teenagers, and parents across the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex.
It was a very shocking turn of events for all of us, and it scared all of us a whole lot, because it can happen to someone as positive an all-American girl as Carla. It can happen to any of us. So we were all very shaken by it. We were all frightened by it. Our parents were all freaked out about it, obviously, and everyone kind of kept tabs on each other a little bit more than we used to. I remember very well after it happened that I had a babysitting job and had driven myself to the babysitting job, but my parents were like, you have to call us as soon as you get there, and you have to call us before you leave there. So I mean, everyone started really keeping tabs on their children, especially girls after that, but also boys, because Rodney got severely beaten in the abduction. I know after that I couldn't sleep. I was just frightened, and I think a lot of us were. I couldn't stay in my own room for probably a week. I slept in my parents' room because it was just so frightening and so traumatizing. And of course, all of us who are around them remember it vividly, and we have talked later on as adults about how it felt like we sort of all lost our innocence at that point.
A few days after her disappearance, a Fort Worth police sergeant ordered patrolmen to search a specific area east of Highway 377 near the lake. Some say it was the result of an anonymous tip. This area had been well searched the previous Monday, according to multiple sources. Because Wednesday night was cold, Fort Worth patrol officers Steve Nooncaster and Daryl Thompson took turns exiting their patrol vehicle to peer into culverts next to roads around Benbrook Lake. About 1 mile east of Highway 377, on what was then called Holiday Park Lane, Thompson exited the vehicle and peered down into the culvert that fell on his turn. This particular incline lay just behind an area beyond a barbed wire fence. Officer Thompson yelled, "Steve, she's under the bridge here." Thinking his partner was pulling one over on him, Nooncaster replied, "Get your ass back in the car, Daryl." Unfortunately, Thompson wasn't kidding. It was 6:35 p.m. on February 20th, 1974. The officers didn't want to call it in. The press was relentlessly scanning the police radio channel in hopes for fresh news on the case. One of the two officers rushed to a payphone to report the find, and one stayed behind to keep an eye on the area. About 20 Tarrant County, Fort Worth, and Benbrook officers emerged on the scene, and a large perimeter around the scene was sealed off quickly so that it would not be disturbed. Carla Walker's partially clad body was found inside a muddy, concrete cattle culvert. "She looked like a sleeping doll," one officer would later remark. The Fort Worth Police Department's crime lab scoured the area for clues. Carla laid in her dress, now dirty and tattered. Her bra, watch, two rings, and a bracelet were still intact. There was bruising around Carla's head, face, mouth, neck, and lower extremities. Due to the cold, it would prove difficult for the medical examiner to determine an exact time of death upon the immediate inspection of Carla's body. Later that evening at the All Saints Hospital, Doris and Layton were called to the morgue. They identified their daughter's jewelry, a senior ring and a topaz ring, before identifying Carla's body. What they all feared the most, but also what they relentlessly kept their minds from wandering to over the course of the past 3.5 days, was realized. This nightmare was happening. This was real.
I remember very well sitting in front of the news and watching them when they had found Carla's body, and watching them move the body bag out of the ditch that they found her in near Benbrook Lake. It was devastating for us to see that.
Carla's funeral was held on Friday, February 22nd. The coming of death is worse when it comes with startling alarm, Minister Elton Dilbeck said to the large nave at the Western Hills Church of Christ which literally overflowed into the halls and beyond the doors with mourners. The 600-seat auditorium was packed with friends, family, and schoolmates of Carla Walker. It was filled to more than double its capacity. Rodney and the Walker family sat in mourning, hardly able to look in the way of the delicate white casket, trimmed in gold and pink, that was positioned directly in front of them. Mr. Walker had ordered the service and visitation be open casket. Carla was wearing a flowing, soft, pink and white dress. Wreaths and floral bouquets and displays lined any free space that might have otherwise been around the minister and his pulpit. As the service ended, the crowd was directed to exit in a way in which viewing Carla in her casket was unavoidable. Many paused and cried, while others found it difficult to look, perhaps grasping onto the thin thread of denial that remained in them, that looking at the young woman would have them face a reality that was much too horrible to bear. Police in attendance scanned the visitors, looking for anything out of the ordinary. The forced movement past the casket was no accident.
Very traumatic. That's the best way to describe it. And it's so odd because at the time I thought I was the only one that was having such a trauma from it. But turns out I wasn't. A lot of people have posted on Facebook about how that funeral traumatized them and basically scarred them for life. I know it certainly did me. I couldn't go to a funeral for a very long time after that one. But almost the whole school went to Carla's funeral. I don't remember if they forced us, but I know that it was, you were routed in a way that you, they wanted you to go past the casket because the police was there in force. And the thinking I found out was that they were looking to see if perhaps her abductors had come to the funeral. I don't know if that's something abductors do, but that they were grasping at anything at the time, I think, and they were looking to see people's reactions and look for people who looked out of place again. And so, anyway, I do very much remember filing past that casket.
The parking lot spilled out onto the streets into what looked like a never-ending sea of cars. Students, friends, and family wept, embraced, and consoled one another as they waited for what seemed like an interminable procession to begin. Carla Jan Walker was laid in her final resting place at the Greenwood Memorial Park Cemetery at 2 p.m. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Department at 817-392-4307. Coming up on Gone Cold Podcast, we'll take a close look at the investigation and the suspects. But first, we will hear from Carla's sister Cindy and brother Jim, who will help provide us with a sense of who Carla was and what they remember about the night of the abduction. We'd like to thank Western Hills alum Kathy O'Neill for all her help, time, and contributions. My name is Vincent, and along with Erica, who researches, we will feature unsolved murders and missing persons cases throughout the state of Texas. We'll be concentrating on the facts, intricacies, and the possible deficiencies of the investigations. More importantly, though, we'll get to know the victim so that the impact of what was lost can be as accurately realized as possible. You can subscribe and download Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or virtually anywhere else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Twitter or Facebook by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we will post pictures about the case, including one of Carla on the night of the dance. Please join us. If you would like to support the show, please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, and share with a friend, or stop by our Patreon page and make a small donation. We'd also like to thank thetruecrimefiles.com, where you will find an abundance of unsolved cases, all presented respectfully with compassion and fantastic insight. Thanks for listening, y'all.